Hello, everyone. My name is Matt Dan, and I am talking today to Milena Lazarevich, and I am sure she will correct my pronunciation of her name. She is the program director at CEP Belgrade, and I hope that she'll also tell us how to say that in Serbian. Hello, Milena.
Hello, Matt. Nice to see you. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to see you. Nice to talk to you too. I am really grateful that you have spared the time to talk to me and to be my first guest for the podcast for my very small consultancy for think tanks and nonprofit organizations.
It's a pleasure and an honor to be the first guest, really.
You are too kind. The idea is that I want to provide something for practitioners in our sector to listen to be able to get some empathy, to understand that the situations they're working in are similar for other people. I hope that in exploring the topics we talk about, that people who listen will get some tips about how to do their jobs better and how to perform better as think tanks. Yeah, that's the idea. Let's first of all start with you. I know that you are Serbian. Were you born in Serbia? What kind of education did you have? What made you decide to move into the think tank sector?
So yes, I was born in Serbia. I grew up in a relatively small town in central Serbia. I graduated from high school at a very bad time for my country. Right after the NATO bombings in 1999, and I was not very inspired to study in Serbia. I looked for opportunities to study abroad, and luckily for me, at that time, the Soros Foundation was offering scholarships for young, promising, talented students with excellent English from Serbia, Montenegro, and several other Western Balkan countries, including Kosovo, Albania. I got a full scholarship and I went on to study at the American University in Bulgaria, AUBG, where after 4 years in 2004, I graduated with a double major in international relations and European studies with a minor in fine art. After that, I went on to an advanced master program at the College of Europe, I guess in EU circles, quite a famous educational institution based in Bruges in Belgium. But I chose to study at the Warsaw campus, which was more focused on transition processes, EU accession processes. Mm-hmm. And then in 2005, after obtaining my MA, I went back to Serbia. It was a better time for my country. It was a time of hope and speeding transition and a lot of enthusiasm surrounding the whole process of EU integration. I was sure that, you know, if I come back and work for my government, that by 2012, Serbia would be an EU member state. I was really motivated and I wanted to come back to work in my country.
So what roles did you take with the government?
Well, I started to work at the beginning. I mean, I was a civil servant from the very beginning, and I worked in the European Integration Office of the Serbian government, which was sort of an excellence government institution, which gathered a lot of young people, very motivated, very, very highly skilled. And we were working directly under the Deputy Prime Minister, driving the process of Serbia's EU integration, doing all the expert work behind the process. I was focused on the institutional building and governance reforms. But then I decided after 2 years at the EU Integration Office that I really wanted to get into the sector, into the policy sector that I was focusing on, which was governance and administration. So I moved to the Ministry of Public Administration and Local Self-Government, where I spent another 3.5 years, again, as a civil servant, where I worked specifically on linking public administration reform with the EU integration process. Mm-hmm. You ask why I decided to go get into the think tank sector, right?
Yes. Yeah.
At a certain point, you know, you realize that there is only as much as you can do as a civil servant. Somehow you hit the ceiling pretty fast, especially in countries where merit basis really developed. So I wasn't politically engaged and I had no plans to get engaged in politics. And as an ordinary civil servant, the course of advancing in career was just too slow for me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I wanted to do something more creative, something more inspiring. And with my husband at that time and several other colleagues of the same sector, so we were all colleagues, partners in work, all dealing with international relations and EU integration processes, several of us, we decided to create a think tank. We were for a long time discussing that we wanted to start some sort of an NGO. We didn't exactly know what kind of an NGO, but we decided that it should be a think tank because we saw that there was really a gap in this part of the policymaking system and process in Serbia. We saw that there was very little supply of quality analyses and research for policymakers. And at the same time, that the policymakers themselves were not, and the decision makers were not really interested in evidence and analyses and research as sources of decision making and creation of government policies. So we said, okay, we will create a think tank, but with a double objective. One, to actually create evidence and create supply for the policy cycle, for the policy creation. But then we said, okay, but we also have to somehow stimulate demand because the demand side was not there either. So from the very early stages, we started to actually also work horizontally on driving the reform of the policymaking processes in Serbia. So yeah, this is how CEP Belgrade came about. In English, we are called European Policy Center, but we insist on our Serbian abbreviation in order not to be confused with the Brussels-based DPC. So we always call ourselves CEP or CEP Belgrade.
I call you CEP Belgrade as well. When you and your friends and colleagues decided to begin a think tank, were there any existing organizations that you took inspiration from? Did you feel like the environment in which you were creating this think tank was a receptive one? Because as you said, you had to create the supply of information and the demand from government and other policy influential individuals to seek out evidence-based policy suggestions. How was that process?
Of course, there were some think tanks already existing in Serbia. There was, let's say, an existing market that we were joining. But we somehow wanted to also be different and to be modern, or I don't know, to somehow join a process that was starting at that time. And in the early stages, we dubbed ourselves the third generation NGO in Serbia. And what that meant was that, okay, I mean, in Serbia, first of all, there was, you know, in the 90s, there was the first wave of non-governmental organizations that essentially brought down the authoritarian regime of Slobodan Milosevic and that actually fought for obtaining democracy, just, you know, getting to the point where we can call ourselves a democracy in 2000. We called that the first generation NGOs. Then came the second generation NGOs, which were very much focused on processes of democratic consolidation and building of the basic democratic institutions.
Yeah.
They were also very much focused on human rights. They were focused on, you know, basic issues of fight against corruption, electoral processes, etc. But what we saw in the civil sector in Serbia was a huge gap in terms of the actual policy expertise, sectoral policy expertise. We felt that very few NGOs, very few think tanks were focusing at that time on specific policy areas that were becoming increasingly important in the EU accession process, such as environment, such as consumer protection, competition protection, internal market reforms, public administration reform at that time, which was not recognized. I mean, it is now being recognized as this kind of a fundamental area of reform of a country, of a state, but at that time it wasn't. Yeah. So we said, okay, we gather in the network and in the among the founding members and associates which joined our little circle, we gathered a lot of expertise in these various policy areas. And we said, okay, this is what we can bring to the table. This is where we can be, you know, stand out from the rest. But as I wanted to say, I meant to say, little did we know that 10 years later, we would be back to beginnings.
The second that generation we are now again issues
discussing
again. Yeah.
Well, we're basically discussing the very basic, you know, democratic institutions, democratic consolidation issues. Again, once again, specific policy, sectoral policy topics are becoming secondary to the creation and maintenance and you know, preservation of basic democratic institutions. Yeah. So I don't know if this means that we did a bad job. I hope not, but certainly somehow this rock that Sisyphus was pushing towards the top of the hill has started to roll back. And I think we're now trying to chase it and prevent it from going all the way back down.
Obviously, the people who are really responsible for making and implementing policy are politicians. And as you pointed out, before civil servants. So I'm sure you did a great job, but I think the context in which we're all working at the moment is where none of us can take democratic norms, and I'm doing my air quotes there. Democratic norms, you have to preserve them. You have to rebuild them regularly. I think we're seeing that across the world at the moment in some very unlikely places. I also want to talk about the practicalities, sort of setting things up legally. Was that difficult? Do you have any advice for anybody who might want to be trying to do that today in Serbia? And what did you do for money at the beginning?
Founding a non-governmental organization, an association in Serbia, is very simple. I mean, you get three people, you hold your assembly, and you make your founding act, your statute, and that's it. It's quite simple. But actually, kicking off the work of the organization, of course, is a completely different story. Yeah. Unlike some other CSOs that came out of, you know, some donor projects, international cooperation projects, or that came out of, I don't know, some political parties with their support. We were just a bunch of, you know, young civil servants who decided to do something crazy. So we actually except for our own expertise and belief in ourselves and in what we could do, we didn't have anything. It was really starting out of thin air. And what did we do for money? Well, we were working hard as consultants. We were working hard on other jobs and investing money in actually getting an office space, hiring at least one or two people in the first year so that we can actually start having a team, because without a team, you cannot build an organization. So in the beginning, I mean, it was practically, you know, a classical kind of investment. We were also very open to partner up with other organizations from the very beginning, and we were very keen and eager to accept cooperation and collaboration on projects where our partner would formally lead the project, but maybe do smaller share of the work. And we would assume most of the work with a smaller share as a junior partner, because we were aware that we didn't have references, we didn't have a track record. We were often being asked, you know, when we would organize an event or, you know, apply for a project, people would really very sincerely ask us, who are you guys? I mean, where did you come from? A school society in Serbia tends to sometimes be, you know, I mean, at least at that time, it was a little bit of a closed circle, you know, I mean, organizations that had been around for some time, and we just came out of nowhere and we were not coming from the same kind of, you know, environment. So yeah, I think we confused a lot of people, but we grew quite fast. We grew exponentially, actually. In the first several years, we were tripling our budgets every year. We were very successful in writing and obtaining projects because we really did have, I mean, and maybe I can be a little bit unmodest here and say that, you know, I came into this business, into this sector with very good English writing skills and very good project writing skills, which somehow came naturally to me. And I was already doing that in the government. I was always working on project cooperation between the Serbian government and international donors. We were just quite successful in writing very good proposals and persuading some donors that they should invest in us.
So at the beginning, in terms of raising money, was that one of your responsibilities and the responsibilities of your new colleagues who were also doing research? Do you have somebody now who raises money for you who doesn't do research?
At the very beginning, of course, when we were a small team of four or five people, everybody was doing everything. So I was probably sharing my time 50-50 between developing new projects and working on, you know, research and implementation of the existing projects. As the team grew, we realized that, you know, people are not equally good in everything that we need to do as a think tank. Yep. And that it would make sense to, we understood the importance of management versus the importance of research as a skill.
Yeah.
whereas there are some people who like to combine the two things and who are good at combining the two things, I've always liked to combine, you know, developing new projects and writing new projects, for example, with managing and doing research. Uh-huh. But I don't like to manage projects. I don't like to be a manager in charge of, you know, reporting and writing emails to partners about what is missing from the documentation and writing financial reports and things like that. Right now, we have a basic structure, which is organized through two main, we can call them pillars, or two main parts of the structure. We have a project structure, which is basically the supporting structure of the organization. And then we have the program structure, which is the content structure of the organization. The lead, the head of the program structure is me as program director. Uh-huh. The head of the project structure is my colleague and my peer, Ranka Miljanović, who is the executive director of the organization. And we are sort of, you know, the two-headed monster in terms of the daily operations. Mm-hmm. In terms of the overall management and leadership of the organization, Ranka and I are members also of the governing board of the organization, but the governing board also has the chairman of the, it's currently the chairman, one day it might be a chairwoman, but right now it's a chairman of the governing board, Srđan Majstorović, who does not participate in day-to-day operations and day-to-day management of the organization, but who is providing more sort of a strategic, let's say, bird's view leadership of the organization. He's also somebody that represents us very often in the media, in the donor community, etc., who helps with ideas, participates in important debates, etc., but he does not deal with operational things in terms of managing the organization. Yeah. Whereas Ranka and I, we deal with everyday business. And then also we have some people who are, of course, let's say, mid-level management. We have colleagues who, for example, in my structure, in the program structure, I have three program managers who are leading three out of four program areas. One of the program areas is asleep right now, so we don't have a program manager because of lack of funding. But for the remaining three, we have program managers who are working, you know, on day-to-day management of their specific program areas. And then Ranka is the executive director who leads the management part, operational management and project management part of the organization. She has a senior project manager who is sort of the team leader of all the people doing project management in the organization. Mm-hmm. So what we try to have in every initiative and every project that we manage is to have somebody who is a professional and dedicated manager. And then we have researchers. Then we have people, you know, who basically just focus on the contents. In reality, it is never a completely, you know, there is not Chinese wall between the two structures. We have colleagues who really like to share their work between the two structures. And this is absolutely allowed. There is no reason not to let people who want to do that do that. But for those colleagues who really, you know, just want to be researchers and do their thing, write and read and write and analyze and, you know, do interviews and surveys, we don't make them deal with the managerial and logistical and operational issues. However, they do participate in fundraising in terms of providing ideas, in terms of providing contents, because our work is fully project-based. So this is maybe something that is important to say. Unlike some Western European think tanks, for example, that have basic costs, operational costs covered already from somewhere.
With core funding.
With core funding, we don't have core funding. So all of our operations, so all the salaries, all the activities, everything has to come from some project or from some overheads that we create through some projects where we can create an overhead. Basically, people who deal with who are researchers, they also have to contribute with their ideas, but then somebody has to actually write those projects and turn them into a proper project proposal. And most often, those are people in the project structure who are doing that. I, for example, I've always been good at writing projects. I like to write projects. We cannot afford for me not to participate in project writing. So when we have some major big proposals, I have to write projects. I mean, I still do that.
I have two questions for you now. So the first is, Where and how did you find partners in order to put projects together? Were those partners initially just in Serbia, or were they also in the Western Balkans? Were they in the EU or indeed elsewhere in the world? And then the other question I want to ask you is about, in think tanks in the Western Balkans, you have this phenomenon whereby the person or people who found the organization then go on to lead it forever and ever and ever until they die. And I have to say, actually, that's also, you know, that's I'm thinking of a very big think tank in the US where the same person led the think tank for more than 25 years. So it's not just a Western Balkan thing. Was that a deliberate choice on behalf of you and your colleagues to, I mean, were you aware of sort of building an institution that would survive you? Or is that the result of you guys getting together and working out, well, actually, we need to be really well managed with professional managers in order to be able to thrive?
Well, I think it was only in the first 2 years of our existence, or year and a half, that we were focused only on partners in Serbia because of my already pre-existing friendships, connections in the region, dating from back from my studies. We managed to find partners in the Western Balkan region. And already in 2013, we started together with a think tank from now North Macedonia, Macedonia at the time, and we called European Policy Institute, EPI, and a think tank based in Podgorica in Montenegro called Institute Alternativa. We started a regional network of think tanks. It was only three of us at the beginning. One of my former friends, very good friends from university, was one of the founders of EPI in Macedonia. One of my best colleagues and friends also from university was one of the founders of Institute Alternativa in Montenegro. And I mean, this naturally served as the first motivation to start working with them. And it turned out that they really grew to become the leading think tanks in their countries too. Then we expanded this network, which is now called the Think for Europe Network, TEN. We expanded it later on through project collaboration to the rest of the Western Balkans. So now as a network, I believe the most developed network of think tanks in this region. We're covering the whole region, all the six countries. And then increasingly so, we started to look for partners in the EU. Our, let's say, biggest and the most important partner in the EU in terms of also the size of project collaboration so far has been EPC in Brussels. Mm-hmm. But we have also worked with Bruegel in some instances. We have also worked in some EU member state-based think tanks such as Istituto Affari Internazionali in Rome. We have worked with some organizations and some think tanks in Hungary, in Slovakia, in Poland, et cetera, et cetera. So we are now we're working, for example, with Aspen Institute in Germany, et cetera. Now with Kliegen, with the Kliegendal also in the Netherlands. So now this international cooperation is really thriving. We are now a very well recognized think tank, not only in the region, but also increasingly internationally. We have been ranked as the one of the top 10 think tanks in Central and Eastern Europe in the Global Go-To Think Tank report since 2018. Yep. We take a lot of pride in that. So, you know, now it is becoming increasingly easy, but of course the first steps were not so easy, but we took all the opportunities that we could find. In terms of how we organize ourselves and why we did so, I don't think, honestly, I don't think it was motivated, you know, by this idea that, you know, our child needs to be able to walk even when the parents are not there anymore. I think, you know, we are quite a young organization still. I mean, we haven't been around even for 10 years yet. I mean, we were founded formally in September 2011. So in autumn this year, we will celebrate our first 10-year anniversary. We have already changed once our management structure, and the first director, Nebojša Lazarević, left that position, I think, probably 4 years ago. He's now involved as an associate founder of the organization, but he's no longer in the director position. The Srđan Majstorović, who is now the chairman of the organization, of the think tank, used to be our colleague and actually was my first boss in the government, in the Serbian European Integration Office. Uh-huh. And when he decided to leave the government, we offered him position of the chairman of the governing board because we really thought that would be a great benefit for us, but also a good opportunity for him. And it turned out to be true. Danka, who is now the executive director, actually was hired by us to be a project manager. And she was really that good that at one point the assembly of the organization decided to invite her to become the executive director. So we have changed our structure. I cannot say that, you know, the parents are no longer there. The parents are still there. Mm-hmm. And I cannot afford yet, for example, to leave the organization. I'm not thinking about that, but I don't think that I will want to be around forever. So I will probably always be, you know, involved in some way, maybe through the governing board or through some sort of an advisory board. We have mm-hmm. an advisory council, but in any case. So, you know, at some point things will probably change. I mean, we all should grow up and evolve and look for other opportunities, but it's also important to build the capacity and the structure from within. I think that, you know, we need good managerial and good organizational structure to be a good organization and to be a good employer and to make sure that people actually want to work with us. And this is why we have created such a strong organizational structure from the very early days.
That's a very good point, actually, to also consider how you're going to be as an employer and to be attractive to people.
I mean, retention, staff retention in our sector is quite a problem. I can tell you that. I mean, we have lost several people to Brussels so far because, yes. I mean, our people are quite good. They become quite good and, you know, I mean, they get good jobs in Brussels and in the EU. We have also lost a few people to, you know, international organizations and donor organizations who can simply afford to pay bigger salaries. But we are trying to be competitive and we're doing everything that we can to, you know, keep people on board, not only through competitive salaries. There are some sectors with which we cannot compete. Simply, it's not possible. Yeah. But also by being, you know, really kind of a good family for them, a good place, a place where they feel safe, where they feel wanted, where they feel, you know, during COVID, where they feel protected, where they feel that, you know, their managers and employers are actually caring about them. So, yeah.
On staff retention, I think that's a good topic to focus on because I think that even the richest think tanks, even the big US think tanks will sometimes find it hard to keep people. What I've noticed is that for some of them, they use the model of attracting people who have had a long career and sort of crown their career by having this sort of space to share their ideas, to say the kind of things that they wish, well, maybe not wish, that they could have said when they were policymakers but couldn't. And those people don't really need the money and they enjoy the prestige of being in the organization. The other thing that I found convincing when I was in a think tank recruiting young researchers was there were two things. Number one was to say to them that their freedom to say what they want was probably worth, I don't know, 10% of the salary that they might have gotten, let's say, in the EU civil service. And then the other thing that I found was useful in attracting good people was to say, okay, you're going to lose 10% of your salary, but you've got freedom to say whatever you want. And the other thing is you have a great platform to stand on. We will support you in becoming a well-known researcher. We will give you the kind of training in the media and op-ed writing and so on in order to be able to, at the end of your 5 years or 7 years here, to be able to go back into whatever structure you're in before, but four or five steps higher than where your former colleagues were. Does that work for you? I mean, are those two good arguments for getting young people, younger, clever people to stay with you? And do you also benefit from sort of attracting people towards the end of their career?
The simplest answer is no. yeah, I mean, this is really an exception and not even end of career, but maybe mid-career. One of our colleagues who is now program manager, he's a mid-career professional who decided to leave the government and joined us but he was also with us from the very beginning. He was one of the founders too. So kind of, you know, I mean, he stayed in the government for a while, but then decided to join us. And one of the main reasons, I guess, was because he saw this space for freedom and independence that he was already really missing in the government. So that is a good point. I think that one of the reasons why this logic or this rationale for attracting older professionals, end of career professionals does not work in Serbia is because in our area, in what we do, there are very few end of career professionals. We do have some, you know, older colleagues who work in state-owned institutes who have been, you know, there for a long time. We do have some colleagues from the civil service who are still, you know, ambassador, who are still diplomats, who occasionally write for us, who occasionally work with us as external associates. But we have not made steps in terms of recruiting them as part of our staff yet. But they do work as external contributors. So some sort of part-time fellows, or however it would be called in Western European think tanks. We don't really have the same structure, the same logic. But in terms of the full-time researchers and the full-time staff of the think tank, we're mainly focused on young professionals from, we have been mainly focused on the young professionals from the civil service, the promising ones who have, you know, gained some experience in the government and have decided that it's not really, you know, something that they want to pursue. So people who are kind of similar to us, the founders. But then in the last years, and I have to say that unfortunately, I think the reason why we have shifted from that approach in the last couple of years is that there are fewer and fewer high quality people coming out of the government.
Yeah.
Or there are fewer and fewer high quality people coming into the government who then want to leave the government. So I think that, you know, the whole merit-based recruitment has really deteriorated in Serbia in the past years. And we do not see as many high quality candidates that we could recruit from the government. But then on the other side, we have been able to attract quite a few very bright young graduates who by now have already, you know, followed us through their studies, who know who we are by the time they want to apply for an internship or a job with us. And we have been quite successful in attracting returning Serbian students from abroad. And this is something that I take particular pride in, because I think that, you know, as a returning, as somebody who returned from studies abroad to my country myself, that's now 16 years ago, 15 and a half years ago, I really have always wanted, and I mean, the whole team in CEP has wanted to make a good home for young professionals, young graduates who want to come back to Serbia and obtain working experience in their home country after studying abroad. And I think that this kind of, you know, brain circulation, stimulating and accommodating this kind of brain circulation is really excellent. In some cases, they decide after a few years that they want to go back to the West, you know. They get disappointed with the quality of life or with some, you know, some conditions of living in Serbia, or, you know, sometimes it's for personal reasons. They go after a boyfriend or a girlfriend for whatever reasons. Sometimes they leave, but in many cases they do stay. And what we are trying to stimulate is a sense of responsibility also towards your local community and towards your country. It's great to be a citizen of the world. I consider myself a citizen of the world, you know. I feel myself at home in many different places around Europe. And I mean, it's maybe because, you know, I do speak several foreign languages and I can get around. But it's one thing to work somewhere as a consultant and just, you know, be part of some huge sea of lobbyists, consultants, analysts. It's a completely different thing to be participating and have a sense and a feeling of participating in some core reforms and processes in your country. We are now, as a country, going through a rough patch because there is a big sense of disappointment because the country is not progressing as it should be right now. Mm-hmm. But I think that now is the time when we should not be giving up. Now is the time when, you know, I mean, especially those of us in this sector who have been around for a while and who have seen things go down and then get back on track. Now we need to stay strong. Now we need to stay committed. Now we need to, you know, keep working and keep pushing from below, from the side, from above, you know, stimulating top-down conditionalities from the EU, stimulating citizen demand from below, stimulating all sorts of, you know, partnerships to try to push our governments here in the region to do the right thing and here in Serbia to do the right things.
Yep.
So, you know, we kind of try to motivate these young people with these messages. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. It's a personal thing and it's a personal decision in the end. But by creating a good atmosphere and a good team, and I think that all of our employees really appreciate the great atmosphere that we have. Mm-hmm. People are friends, people go for drinks after work. I mean, when it's not COVID, obviously. Normally, you know, in the normal times, we used to have parties or aperitivos every last Friday of the month where people would just gather over drinks and just, you know, chat and sing together and just enjoy, you know, spending some quality time together outside of work. but with their colleagues.
Your comment about Serbia going through a rough patch at the moment reminds me of something else that I find interesting. But first, let me say, I've always been impressed by you and all of your colleagues, because for most of you, the people that I've met, they really could, you really could go and do any work anywhere in the world and be rewarded well for it. And at some point you've chosen to take a more difficult path in order to enrich your local community, as you said. And let me just say, and I've said this to you before, you know, I'm really impressed with that. And that's
Thank you.
Offering people a platform in which to say anything at the moment in Serbia could be a double-edged sword, because my understanding is that in Serbia and in other places in the Western Balkans, and indeed in some parts of the EU, there's kind of been a coordinated smear campaign against third sector organizations, civil society, and think tanks. Has that happened to you? What do you and your colleagues do to fight that? Because I know that a number of our listeners will also be in situations where the work they do won't exactly be welcomed by governments and policymakers.
I have to completely honestly tell you that, you know, we have not been the worst or even one of the worst cases in terms of the smear attacks, smear campaigns and attacks on civil society in our country. So there's some organizations which have really been individually targeted.
Yeah.
We have usually been in individual speeches and addresses from some ministers, and in some cases, you know, through these kind of, you know, implicit accusations, etc. This is becoming more and more common. We have recently had a big meeting of a big civil society platform in Serbia, where a government minister was very explicitly referring to our, let's say, senior management in some very critical and very smearing comments. But we try to, first of all, take the higher ground, if I can say that. We try to ignore that as much as possible. We are doing our thing. What we try to make sure, and I think that we have been relatively successful in that, is to make sure that we have good evidence bases behind every point of criticism that through which we target the government.
Yeah.
And to try to make sure that it's not political, that it's completely objective. In normal circumstances, in a country and with a government which supports and favors diversity and discussion and critical thinking, and which actually understands the value of positive evidence-based criticism and proposals, I think we would have a very, very good trajectory. Right now, I'm not sure that this is the case. I think we're walking a very fine line trying to remain objective and unbiased, where the country is more and more being divided into camps. You're either for or against.
Yeah.
We are increasingly being accused of being against the government. The point is not to be, I mean, my personal political views are my personal thing, but this is not what I am doing in my work. In my work, I'm trying to provide evidence and provide recommendations to the government how to do their job better and how to create a society and a country that is going to be a better home for my children and for their own children. But, you know, right now we are in a kind of an environment where I feel like we are telling the other side that, you know, they have a big milk stain on their lip and we're trying to do them a favor. And they're constantly getting mad at us for telling them that they have a stain on their lip and they don't care about the stain on the lip. Yeah, this is the situation right now. It is, you know, we had a period in the mid-2000s where we could very easily discuss directly with ministers and high-level civil servants about, you know, problems and deficiencies, and where they would very directly accept our proposals. But increasingly, recommendations and criticism, which is coming from any part of the civil sector, including us, are being treated as attacks, as, I don't know, as if we were enemies of the state because we are criticizing some aspects of the work of the government. And in that sense, I think, you know, that the culture of dialogue is really deteriorating in Serbia. Hopefully this, you know, as I said, you know, this rock that Sisyphus has been rolling up, it is now definitely rolling down, and we are trying to make, you know, to put some brakes beneath it and stop it from rolling further back down. We'll see what will happen. We are now employing new strategies, new methods, trying to, you know, work more with citizens, engage more with the citizens, try to persuade the government through the power of citizenry and of citizens' requests and complaints, mm-hmm. rather than through, you know, Brussels says, or this is what you should do for the sake of EU accession. Those old arguments no longer work. We have to be looking for new arguments, and we are doing our best to adapt.
Which brings me on to the other technical topic that I would like to have your views on, and that's communication. Again, I think that you are an organization that takes communication as seriously as you take management and as seriously as you take research. Is that something that you had from the beginning? As you said, you needed to create the demand as well as the supply. So clearly that has a communications perspective. How do you run communications when you clearly have at least two very different audiences and you can't speak to them in the same language? So for many of the bigger think tanks in Western Europe, in the US, and indeed in Central and South America, there's one language in which you can communicate and everybody in the world can follow you, and the local audience can too. Was that approach to communication always there? How would you describe it now? And what are the implications of basically working in a bilingual environment?
So our communication function, of course, developed over time. In the very early days, everybody had to do communications, and we were small and we didn't have the money to pay somebody to do just communications. Of course, we could not start with that in the early days. But thanks to the very generous support of the think tank fund of the Open Society Foundations, with whom we had an institutional building grant for 4 years, we actually built our communication function. And we experimented with different approaches. We tried with having external communication consultants. We tried with, you know, hiring journalists. I think communication officers were the most frequently changing people, you know, in our organization for a while. Then we decided to try something else. We decided to try to find a young professional, somebody who really wants to work in PR and communications, but who doesn't have experience and who maybe has just done an internship. And then we have for a while one external consultant, senior consultant, who would be basically mentoring this new person, helping out, you know, as a senior, and basically help build this internal function. And this has proven to be the magic solution, you know.
Right.
Now, the reason why it seems that we're doing such a great and that we're investing so much in communications is because we have Anessa, our communications coordinator, who is doing the job of three persons, seriously.
Right.
And of course, I mean, other people are doing communications. Everybody, every researcher has to do some communications in their own area. So they talk to the journalists, they go for do interviews, they write commentaries. But Anessa is really the driver behind all of that. We now no longer have the external senior consultant. We simply over time realized that we don't need to pay for that additional position any longer. And Anessa has, you know, built herself as part of our team as an extremely motivated and bright young woman who came to our team straight after university with very, very little previous working experience, just some internships. And she has proven to be, you know, a perfect member of the team who has now acquired so much knowledge, expertise, experience that she's now, you know, making her own initiatives. She's doing a great job. And she's now mentoring a younger member of the team who is helping her out in some communications work, partly in events management.
Yeah. The Serbian audience must need different kind of communications, and they're going to consume a certain part of your work, but then another part of your work is outward facing, yeah, and in a different language.
This is very much decided based on a specific project or a specific initiative. And we, for example, we have our program area, Europe and Us, mm-hmm. where we're mainly communicating to external audiences, to right. EU decision makers, EU member state decision makers, regional audiences, international organizations. Our researchers in the Europe and Us area, they write everything in English first. And then if we have time, we translate it into Serbian. We don't even manage to translate everything into Serbian. In a different program area, internal market and competitiveness, which is very much focused on the domestic institutional and economic policy, institutional building for economic policy and domestic economic policy. Most of the work that is being done first in Serbian, and only what needs to be translated into English is being translated into English. Yeah. The same goes for communication. So basically, we adapt the communication approach to the audiences of the specific initiatives, programs, and projects.
Right.
And this is working fine. I mean, we're trying to be as efficient as possible. I mean, it would be too expensive to translate everything and to have, you know, our Serbian and English web pages are not identical. You know, for a while we were managing, when we were producing live, we were managing to keep them identical. Now it's no longer possible. I mean, and you know, some things which I write in English, when you translate them into Serbian, they don't make sense. I mean, it just doesn't read well. So, you know, sometimes, for example, what we do, if we write a policy piece in English, then we just do a short media piece in Serbian, you know, a completely different one based on the longer English piece. So, you know, we kind of ad hoc develop this approach in line with the needs of a specific initiative or program.
Yeah. Or let me put it in the way a consultant would say it. Basically, what you're doing is you are tailoring the products for different audiences. And what that means in your context is that tailoring the product doesn't mean necessarily translating a paper so it is in two languages. It's saying that this audience, okay, it's in this language, but it's going to be more comfortable consuming it in this way. And the other audience, it's the same idea, it's the same recommendation, it's the same evidence, but you put it in a completely different product because that's the way that that audience is going to consider. And, you know, let me congratulate you on that because that's a very sophisticated approach to communication.
I think we have done that quite intuitively, I have to say.
Now you know the value of it, you can continue. I hope it's interesting for our audiences that they understand that it's not necessary to have a bilingual website that is exactly the same for both languages. That was the standard a few years ago, and I think now it's not necessary. So we're nearing the end of our time. And in fact, you know, you and I love to talk and we love to talk to each other. So in fact, we're way over the time that I said I would take from you. The final thing that we have to talk about is the C word. And the C word nowadays is COVID. Everybody has had to change their working operations. Perhaps you could distill, you know, you don't have to describe all of the changes that you made, but perhaps you could share with us lessons you've learned about all of the things that you've talked about. So one thing is clear is that you're a very people-focused organization. You're a very well-organized organization. You're also an organization that's sort of very tight-knit. What have you learned about your colleagues, about yourself, about your organization during COVID? And what changes will you keep in terms of working practices now for the future once we all are able to live what passed for a normal life before 2020?
Okay, so maybe I would just focus on two main things. One thing that we learned is that we were actually very well prepared for, you know, shifting to this completely remote online working environment. And we had no idea that we were, because it was not something that we expected to happen. But because we are a small and lean and modern organization, from the very early days, you know, everything was in the cloud, everything was on shared folders, everything, you know, all the people had access to everything through the Microsoft software, for which we have had donations from Microsoft for years. They give you their services almost for free, or actually for a very low price if you're a nonprofit organization. Mm-hmm. It was just overnight that, you know, when the state of emergency started in Serbia in March last year, just overnight, we shifted everything online. We had a big Microsoft Teams meeting. We set up regular team meetings. And I think that we actually became a better managed organization since the beginning of COVID. This is the weirdest thing. When we were assuming or presuming that every meeting would have to happen face to face, it was always a problem to set a date or a time for a staff meeting, for a team meeting, etc. So we were constantly, you know, moving them, shifting them around. Now, when everything is in our calendars already and it's online, we never miss our team meetings, our staff meetings. So we actually are more in touch with our staff on a daily basis in terms of, you know, giving them feedback and discussing, you know, problems and bottlenecks in projects and in our work than before COVID. So this is one important thing that we learned. Another thing that, you know, I think everybody in our organization has realized that we are really people-oriented organization.
Yep.
We have really been focused on making sure that our people feel safe.
Right.
We have run a couple of internal surveys for our staff to see, you know, how they're feeling, just checking in with them, you know, what was the problem, if anybody was having some, you know, major difficulties in work.
So how many members of staff do you have?
We are 25.
That's totally impressive that an organization of that kind of size would do not just one, but a couple of internal surveys of all staff. I think that is really commendable, but I interrupted you. Go on.
We should do a third one now. And I think it's long overdue right now. So this reminds me that we really should do another one because we're still mainly working remotely. During the state of emergency, which lasted from mid-March to early May 2020, when, you know, everything was closing at 5 o'clock, we were encouraging people to go and, you know, get their groceries, go do exercise or whatever they needed to do during the working hours and then, you know, finish their work later on in the afternoon or whenever they can, if this, for example, fits them, if they want to do that. Because otherwise, if they spend the whole day working until 5, they just stay locked in the house.
Yep.
So we were, you know, encouraging this kind of flexibility. And then we have been monitoring, you know, the situation. We had one brief period in the early autumn when we asked people to start coming back in shifts. We were making tables with shifts every Friday for the next week. It was relatively flexible. Still, people could change it, but we were monitoring that we don't have more than 10 people in our office at any point in time, because with 10 people, we felt that it was safe enough for everybody to keep the necessary distance. But then, you know, we have also offered flexibility that, you know, we had the third wave and everything went back online. We offered people flexibility. We said, okay, those people who cannot work at home anymore, who feel socially isolated, who just cannot focus anymore, you are free to go to the office. We will keep the office open, but only if you feel safe going to the office. Inform us, let us know. 4 or 5 people who keep going to the office because they prefer. There are others who haven't been in the office for months. So one part of those surveys that we implemented was actually asking people about how they would like to continue working after the pandemic is over. Uh-huh. And to what extent they would like to keep working remotely. And, you know, around half of our team expressed the wish to keep working most of the time or half of the time remotely, even after this thing passes. We will see now, you know, after a whole year of working remotely, if this has changed, because I think everybody, you know, is to an extent sick and tired of working remotely. And, you know, people to an extent also want to go back to the office. But I think that definitely one thing that we are going to retain is much more flexibility around remote work. And ensuring that, you know, people can just, you know, inform us whether, you know, they want to spend, I don't know, 2 days working from home and 3 days working in the office or the other way around in any given week. This is also going to be good for us because we were already running out of office space. And if everybody would be working from the office, we would not have enough desks at this point. So, you know, we don't have to move this way.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your insight. And you know what? Trial and error and flexibility, I think, are great watchwords for think tankers.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you for this opportunity.
And I can't wait until we can actually meet again and talk about these things in person.
In person. Me too. Me too.